I have witnessed mature, emotionally stable adults, both men and women, break down and weep while telling me of events that happened up to 3 decades before. I have detected in their voices sincerity, warmth, and feeling which cannot really be conveyed in a written recounting. So to me, in a way that is unfortunately impossible for many others to share, the notion that these accounts might be fabrications is utterly untenable. In addition to the weight of my own opinion, there are some strong considerations which should rule heavily against the fabrication hypothesis. The most obvious is the difficulty of explaining the similarity of so many of the accounts. How is it that many people just happen to have come up with the same lie to tell me over a period of 8 years? Collusion remains a theoretical possibility here. It is certainly conceivable that a nice elderly lady from eastern North Carolina, a medical student from New Jersey, a Georgia veterinarian, and many others several years ago banded together and conspired to carry out an elaborate hoax against me. However, I don't regard this to be a very likely possibility. If they are not overtly lying, perhaps they are misrepresenting in a more subtle way. Isn't it possible that over the years, they have elaborated their stories? This question points to the well-known psychological phenomenon in which a person may start with a fairly simple account of an experience or event and over a period of time develop it into a very elaborate narrative. With each telling, a subtle detail is added, the speaker coming eventually to believe it himself, until at last the story is so embellished as to bear little resemblance to the original. I do not believe that this mechanism has been operative to any significant degree in the cases I have studied, however. In the first place, the accounts of persons whom I have interviewed very soon after their experience in some cases, while they were still in the hospital recovering, are of the same type as those of people who have recounted experiences which took place decades ago. Further, in a few cases, persons whom I have interviewed wrote down descriptions of their experiences shortly after they happened and read to me from their notes during the interview. Again, these descriptions are of the same sort as experiences which are recounted from memory after lapses of some years. Also, there is the fact that quite often I have been only the first or second person to whom an experience has been related, and then only with great reluctance, even in cases where the experience happened some years before. Though there has been little or no opportunity for embellishment in such cases, these accounts, again, are no different as a group from those accounts that have been retold more often over a period of years. Finally, it is quite possible that in many cases, the reverse of embellishment has taken place. What psychiatrists call suppression is a mental mechanism whereby a conscious effort is made to control undesired memories, feelings, or thoughts, or to conceal them from awareness. On numerous occasions in the course of interviews, persons have made remarks which are strongly indicative that suppression has occurred. For example, one woman who reported to me a very elaborate experience which took place during her death said, "I feel that there is more to it, but I can't remember it all. I tried to suppress it because I knew people weren't going to believe me anyway." A man who suffered a cardiac arrest during surgery for major wounds received in Vietnam related his difficulty in dealing with his out-of-body experiences emotionally. "I get choked up by trying to tell about it even now. I feel that there is a lot I don't remember about it. I have tried to forget it." In short, it seems that a strong case can be made that embellishment has not been a very significant factor in the development of these stories. Did all these people profess a religion before their experiences? If so, aren't the experiences shaped by their religious beliefs and backgrounds? They seem to be to some extent. As mentioned earlier, though the description of the being of light is invariable, the identity ascribed to it varies, apparently as a function of the religious background of the individual. Through all of my research, however, I have not heard a single reference to a heaven or a hell, anything like the customary picture to which we are exposed in this society. Indeed, many persons have stressed how unlike their experiences were to what they had been led to expect in the course of their religious training. One woman who died reported, "I had always heard that when you die, you see both heaven and hell, but I didn't see either one. Another lady who had an out-of-body experience after severe injuries said, "The strange thing was that I had always been taught in my religious upbringing that the minute you died you would be right at these beautiful gates, pearly gates. But there I was hovering around my own physical body, and that was it. I was just baffled." Furthermore, in quite a few instances, reports have come from persons who had no religious beliefs or training at all prior to their experiences, and their descriptions do not seem to differ in content from people who had quite strong religious beliefs. In a few cases, someone who had been exposed to religious doctrines but had rejected them earlier in life acquired religious feelings with new depth after the experience. Others say that although they had read religious writings, such as the Bible, they had never really understood certain things they had read there until their near-death experiences. What bearing, if any, do the experiences which you have studied have on the possibility of reincarnation? Not one of the cases I have looked into is in any way indicative to me that reincarnation occurs. However, it is important to bear in mind that not one of them rules out reincarnation, either. If reincarnation does occur, it seems likely that an interlude in some other realm would occur between the time of separation from the old body and the entry into the new one. Accordingly, the technique of interviewing people who come back from close calls with death would not be the proper mode for studying reincarnation, anyway. Other methods can and have been tried in investigating reincarnation. For example, some have tried the technique of far age regression. A subject is hypnotized and the suggestion is made to him that he go back mentally to successively earlier and earlier times in his life. When he reaches the time of the earliest experiences he can recall in his present life, he is then told to try to go back even beyond that. At this point, many persons begin telling elaborate stories about previous lives in earlier times and distant places. In some cases, such stories check out with remarkable accuracy. This has happened even when it can be established that the subject could not have known in any normal way about the events, persons, and places he describes so accurately. The case of Bridie Murphy is the most famous, but there are many others, some even more impressive and well documented, which are not as widely known. Readers who wish to pursue this question further are referred to the excellent study, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, by Ian Stevenson, MD. It is also worth noting that the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which so accurately recounts the stages of near-death encounters, says that reincarnation does occur at some later point, after the events which have been related by my subjects. Have you ever interviewed anyone who has had a near-death experience in association with a suicide attempt? If so, was the experience any different? I do know of a few cases in which a suicide attempt was the cause of the apparent death. These experiences were uniformly characterized as being unpleasant. As one woman said, "If you leave here a tormented soul, you will be a tormented soul over there, too." In short, they report that the conflicts they had attempted suicide to escape were still present when they died, but with added complications. In their disembodied state, they were unable to do anything about their problems, and they also had to view the unfortunate consequences which resulted from their acts. A man who was despondent about the death of his wife shot himself, died as a result, and was resuscitated. He states, "I didn't go where my wife was. I went to an awful place. I immediately saw the mistake I had made. I thought, I wish I hadn't done it." Others who experienced this unpleasant limbo state have remarked that they had the feeling they would be there for a long time. This was their penalty for breaking the rules by trying to release themselves prematurely from what was, in effect, an assignment to fulfill a certain purpose in life. Such remarks coincide with what has been reported to me by several people who died of other causes but who said that, while they were in this state, it had been intimated to them that suicide was a very unfortunate act which attended with a severe penalty. One man who had a near-death experience after an accident said, "While I was over there, I got the feeling that two things it was completely forbidden for me to do would be to kill myself or to kill another person. If I were to commit suicide, I would be throwing God's gift back in his face. Killing somebody else would be interfering with God's purpose for that individual. Sentiments like these, which by now have been expressed to me in many separate accounts, are identical to those embodied in the most ancient theological and moral argument against suicide, one which occurs in various forms in the writings of thinkers as diverse as St. Thomas Aquinas, Locke, and Kant. A suicide, in Kant's view, is acting in opposition to the purposes of God and arrives on the other side viewed as a rebel against his creator. Aquinas argues that life is a gift from God and that it is God's prerogative, not man's, to take it back. In discussing this, however, I do not pass a moral judgment against suicide. I only report what others who have been through this experience have told me. I am now in the process of preparing a second book on near-death experiences, in which this topic, along with others, will be dealt with at greater length. Do you have any cross-cultural cases? No, I don't. In fact, one of the many reasons I say that my study is not scientific is that the group of individuals to whom I have listened is not a random sample of human beings. I would be very interested in hearing about the near-death experiences of Eskimos, Quakeutl Indians, Navajos, Watusi tribesmen, and so on. However, due to geographic and other limitations, I have not been able to locate any. Are there any historical examples of near-death phenomena? As far as I know, there are not. However, since I have been fully occupied with contemporary instances, I have simply not had the time adequately to research this question. So I would not at all be surprised to find that such reports have been recounted in the past. On the other hand, I strongly suspect that near-death experiences have been vastly more common in the past few decades than in earlier periods. The reason for this is simply that it has only been in fairly recent times that advanced resuscitation technology has been available. Many of the people who have been brought back in our era would not have survived in earlier years. Injections of adrenaline into the heart, a machine which delivers a shock to the heart, an artificial heart and lung machines are examples of such medical advances. Have you investigated the medical records of your subjects? Insofar as possible, I have. In the cases I have been invited to investigate, the records have borne out the assertions of the persons involved. In some cases, due to the passage of time and/or the death of the persons who carried out the resuscitation, records are not available. The reports for which substantiating records are not available are no different from those in which records are available. In many instances when medical records have not been accessible, I have secured the testimony of others' friends, doctors, or relatives of the informant to the effect that the near-death event did occur. I have heard that, after 5 minutes, resuscitation is impossible, yet you say that some of your cases have been dead for up to 20 minutes. How is this possible? Most numbers and quantities one hears quoted in medical practice are means, averages, and are not to be taken as absolutes. The figure of 5 minutes which one often hears quoted is an average. It is a clinical rule of thumb not to attempt resuscitation after 5 minutes because, in most instances, brain damage from lack of oxygen would have occurred beyond that time. However, since it is only an average, one would expect individual cases to fall on either side of it. I have in fact found cases in which resuscitation took place after 20 minutes with no evidence of brain damage. Were any of these people really dead? One of the main reasons why this question is so confusing and difficult to answer is that it is partly a semantic question involving the meaning of the word dead. As the recent heated controversy surrounding the transplantation of organs reveals, the definition of death is by no means settled, even among professionals in the field of medicine. Criteria of death vary not only between laymen and physicians, but also among physicians and from hospital to hospital. So, the answer to this question will depend on what is meant by dead. It will be profitable here to look at three definitions in turn and to comment upon them. 1. Death as the absence of clinically detectable vital signs. Some will be willing to say that a person is dead if his heart stops beating and he quits breathing for an extended period of time, his blood pressure drops as low as to be unreadable, his pupils dilate, his body temperature begins to go down, etc. This is the clinical definition, and it has been employed for centuries by physicians and laymen alike. In fact, most people who have ever been pronounced dead were judged so on the basis of this criterion. There is no question but that this clinical standard was met in many of the cases I have studied. Both the testimony of physicians and the evidence of medical records adequately support the contention that deaths in this sense did take place. 2. Death as the absence of brainwave activity. The advancement of technology has brought the development of more sensitive techniques for detecting biological processes, even those which might not be observable overtly. The electroencephalograph, EEG, is a machine which amplifies and records the minute electrical potentials of the brain. Recently, the trend has been to base assessment of real death on the absence of electrical activity in the brain, as determined by the presence of flat EEG tracings. Obviously, in all of the cases of resuscitation which I have dealt with, there was an extreme clinical emergency. There was no time to set up an EEG. The clinicians were rightly concerned about doing what they could to get their patient back. So, some might argue that none of these persons can be adjudged to have been dead. Suppose for a moment, however, that flat EEG readings had been obtained on a large percentage of the persons who were thought dead and were then resuscitated. Would that fact necessarily add very much here? I think not, for three reasons. First, resuscitation attempts are always emergencies, which last at the very most for 30 minutes or so. Setting up an EEG machine is a very complicated and technical task, and it is fairly common for even an experienced technician to have to work with it for some time to get correct readings, even under optimum conditions. In an emergency, with its accompanying confusion, there would probably be an increased likelihood of mistakes. So, even if one could present a flat EEG tracing for a person who told of a near-death experience, it would still be possible for a critic to say with justice that the tracing might not be accurate. Second, even the marvelous electric brain machine, properly set up, does not enable us infallibly to determine whether resuscitation is possible in any given case. Flat EEG tracings have been obtained in persons who were later resuscitated. Overdoses of drugs which are depressants of the central nervous system, as well as hypothermia, low body temperature, have both resulted in this phenomenon. Third, even if I could produce a case in which it could be established that the machine was correctly set up, there would still be a problem. Someone could say that there is no proof that the reported near-death experience took place during the time the EEG was flat, but rather before or afterwards. I conclude, then, that the EEG is not very valuable at this present stage of investigation. 3. Death as an irreversible loss of vital functions. Others will adopt an even more restricted definition, holding that one cannot say that a person was ever dead, no matter how long his vital signs were clinically undetectable, and no matter how long his EEG was flat, if he was subsequently resuscitated. In other words, death is defined as that state of the body from which it is impossible to be revived. Obviously, by this definition, none of my cases would qualify, since they all involved resuscitation. We have seen, then, that the answer to the question depends upon what is meant by dead. One must remember that even though this is in part a semantic dispute, it is nonetheless an important issue, because all three definitions embody important insights. In fact, I would agree with the third, most stringent definition to some extent. Even in those cases in which the heart was not beating for extended periods, the tissues of the body, particularly the brain, must somehow have been perfused, supplied with oxygen and nourishment, most of the time. It is not necessary that one assume in any of these cases that any law of biology or physiology was violated. In order for resuscitation to have occurred, some degree of residual biological activity must have been going on in the cells of the body, even though the overt signs of these processes were not clinically detectable by the methods employed. However, it seems that it is impossible at present to determine exactly what the point of no return is. It may well vary with the individual, and it is likely not a fixed point but rather a shifting range on a continuum. In fact, A few decades ago, most of the people with whom I have talked could not have been brought back. In the future, techniques might become available which would enable us to revive people who can't be saved today. Let us, therefore, hypothesize that death is a separation of the mind from the body, and that the mind does pass into other realms of existence at this point. It would follow that there exists some mechanism whereby the soul or mind is released upon death. One has no basis upon which to assume, though, that this mechanism works exactly in accordance with what we have in our own era somewhat arbitrarily taken to be the point of no return. Nor do we have to assume that it works perfectly in every instance, any more than we have to assume that any bodily system always works perfectly. Perhaps this mechanism might sometime come into play even before any physiological crisis, affording a few persons a brief glimpse of other realities. This would help to account for the reports of those persons who have had flashbacks of their lives, out-of-body experiences, etc., when they felt certain that they were about to be killed, even before any physical injury occurred. All I ultimately want to claim is this: whatever that point of irretrievable death is said to be, whether in the past, present, or future, those with whom I have talked have been much closer to it than have the vast majority of their fellow human beings. For this reason alone, I am quite willing to listen to what they have to say. In the final analysis, though, it is quite pointless to cavil over the precise definition of death, irreversible or otherwise, in the context of this discussion. What the person who raises such objections to near-death experiences seems to have in mind is something more basic. He reasons that as long as it remains a possibility that there was some residual biological activity in the body, then that activity might have caused, and thus account for, the experience. Now, I granted earlier that there must have been some residual biological function in the body in all cases. So, the issue of whether a real death occurred really reduces to the more basic problem of whether the residual biological function could account for the occurrence of the experiences. In other words, aren't other explanations, that is, other than survival of bodily death, possible? This in turn brings us to the topic of the next chapter. 5. Explanations. Of course, alternative explanations of near-death phenomena are available. In fact, from the purely philosophical point of view, an infinity of hypotheses could be constructed to explain any experience, observation, or fact. That is, one could go on forever manufacturing more and more theoretically possible explanations for anything one wanted to explain. It is the same in the case of near-death experiences. All sorts of possible explanations present themselves. Out of the many kinds of explanations which might theoretically be proposed, there are a few which have been suggested quite frequently in the audiences which I have addressed. Accordingly, I shall now deal with these more common explanations, and with another which, though it has never been proposed to me, might well have been. I have somewhat arbitrarily divided them into three types: supernatural, natural, scientific, and psychological. Supernatural explanations. Rarely, someone in one of my audiences has proposed demonic explanations of near-death experiences, suggesting that the experiences were doubtless directed by inimical forces. As a response to such explanations, I can only say this. It seems to me that the best way of distinguishing between God-directed and Satan-directed experiences would be to see what the person involved does and says after his experience. God, I suppose, would try to get those to whom he appears to be loving and forgiving. Satan would presumably tell his servants to follow a course of hate and destruction. Manifestly, my subjects have come back with a renewed commitment to follow the former course and to disavow the latter. In the light of all the machinations which a hypothetical demon would have to have carried out in order to delude his hapless victim, and to what purpose? He certainly has failed miserably as far as I can tell to make persuasive emissaries for his program. Natural, scientific explanations. 1. The pharmacological explanation. Some suggest that near-death experiences are caused by the therapeutic drugs administered to the person at the time of his crisis. The surface plausibility of this view derives from several facts. For example, It is generally agreed by most medical scientists and laymen that certain drugs cause delusional and hallucinatory mental states and experiences. Furthermore, we are now passing through an era in which there is intense interest in the problem of drug abuse, and much public attention has focused on the illicit use of drugs such as LSD, marijuana, and so forth, which do appear to cause such hallucinatory episodes. Finally, there is the fact that even many medically accepted drugs are associated with various effects on the mind which may resemble the events of the experience of dying. For example, the drug ketamine, or cyclohexanone, is an intravenously injected anesthetic with side effects which are similar in some respects to out-of-body experiences. It is classified as a dissociative anesthetic because during induction the patient may become unresponsive not only to pain but also to the environment as a whole. He feels dissociated from his environment, including the parts of his own body, his legs, arms, and so forth. For a time after recovery, he may be left with psychological disturbances, including hallucinations and very vivid dreams. Note that a few persons have used this very word dissociation to characterize their feelings while in the out-of-body state. What is more, I have collected a few accounts from people who, while under anesthetics, had what they plainly identified as hallucinatory type visions of death. Let me give one example. It was sometime in my early teenage years. I was in the dentist's office for a filling and was given nitrous oxide. I was kind of nervous about taking it, because I was afraid I wouldn't wake up again. As the anesthesia began to take effect, I felt myself going around in a spiral. It wasn't like I was turning around, but like the dentist's chair was moving in a spiral upward, and it was going up and up and up. Everything was very bright and white, and as I got to the top of the spiral, angels came down to meet me and to take me to heaven. I use the plural, angels, because it's very vague, but I'm sure that there were more than one. Yet I can't say how many. At one point the dentist and nurse were talking to each other about another person, and I heard them, but by the time they finished a sentence I couldn't even remember what the first of the sentence had been. But I knew they were talking, and as they did their words would echo around and around. It was an echo that seemed to get further and further away, like in the mountains. I do remember that I seemed to hear them from above, because I felt as though I was up high, going to heaven. That's all I remember, except that I hadn't been afraid or panicked at the thought of dying. At that time in my life, I was afraid of going to hell, but when this happened there was no question in my mind but that I was going to heaven. I was very surprised later that the thought of death hadn't bothered me. But finally it dawned on me that in my anesthetized state nothing bothered me. The whole thing was just happy because I'm sure the gas made me completely carefree. I blamed it on that. It was such a vague thing. I didn't dwell on it afterwards. Notice that there are a few points of similarity between this experience and some others which have been taken to be real by those to whom they happened. This woman describes a brilliant white light, meeting others who are there to take her to the other side, and lack of concern over being dead. There are also two aspects which suggest an out-of-body experience. Her impression that she heard the voices of the dentist and nurse from a position above them, and her feeling of floating. On the other hand, other details of this story are very atypical of near-death experiences which are reported as having actually happened. The brilliant light is not personified and no ineffable feelings of peace and happiness occurred. The description of the after-death world is very literalistic and, she says, in accordance with her religious training. The beings who met her are identified as angels, and she talks of going to a heaven which is located in the up direction, where she is headed. She denies seeing her body or being in any other kind of body, and she plainly feels that the dentist's chair, and not her own motion, was the source of the rotatory movement. She repeatedly stresses the vagueness of her experience, and it apparently had no effect on her belief in an afterlife. In fact, she now has doubts about survival of bodily death, in comparing reports in which the experience is plainly attributed to a drug with near-death experiences which are reported as real. Several points need to be mentioned. First of all, The few people who have described such drug experiences to me are no more and no less romantic, imaginative, intelligent, or stable than are the persons reporting real near-death experiences. Secondly, these drug-induced experiences are extremely vague.